Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Couple of key words there that we just heard. Real conversations. We'll talk conversations today. And connecting faith. And, of course, connecting, you pretty much need conversation to do that.
Absolutely.
That's part of it. So we're talking about today. I'm Neil Stavem, Ted Ross at the controls. And, Ted, I got a couple of quotes today, one from Yogi Berra, one from Fran Lebowitz.
So, oh, man.
You ready to go?
That's running the gamut, I think.
Sure. Yeah. Yogi Berra said, it was impossible to get a conversation going. Everybody was talking too much. Yogi can say. And Fran Lebowitz has said, a conversation has two parts. There's talking and then waiting to talk.
Yeah.
Which is one of the issues, of course, is that we don't actually listen because we're waiting to talk. And like this from Wendell Berry, who said, better than any argument is to rise at dawn and pick dew-wet red berries in a cup. So, all right, that's probably where I kind of land on that side. Well, you know, discussing topics and issues that matter most takes time and attention. And as our guest is going to offer today, some tips and training for having difficult conversations. That's the title of the book we're going to reference. And fortunately, our guest is kind and gracious. She grew up in the Midwest, so an all-around nice person. It shouldn't be a difficult conversation with Sheila Heen at all. At least it won't be for her. I, on the other hand, have perfected the art of avoiding difficult conversations. We'll see how that goes. Hey, before we jump into the topic, warm welcome to May. Not particularly warm across the upper Midwest, but we'll celebrate that anyway. And thank you for listening to Faith Radio. A couple things you notice this month. We're doing a study Bible giveaway, especially if you're women, called She Reads Truth. And you can sign up for that just in time for Mother's Day. We'll be giving one away each week here through Mother's Day. So sign up online at myfaithradio.com. And also this month, you'll be hearing about the good work of Food for the Poor. They're one of the organizations that serves the missionaries, churches, and aid workers with the supplies they need to help be the hands and feet of Jesus. So thanks for considering their good work, and check that out as well.
Good opportunities there. There's also a little video on the She Reads Truth Bible on the website, so you can check that out, too.
Yeah, check it out, myfaithradio.com. And it's a great drawing and be something that, you know, mom or your wife or, you know, sister, daughter would really appreciate. So you can sign up today, myfaithradio.com. Let me introduce Sheila Heen. Sheila has been our guest in the past, and we're honored to have her back with us. She's founder and CEO of Triad Consulting Group and a lecturer on law at Harvard Law School and the Harvard Negotiation Project. And she's co-author of the book we're going to discuss today, Difficult Conversations, How to Discuss What Matters Most. Last time we had her on, we were talking about her most recent book. Is called Thanks for the Feedback, The Science and Art of Receiving Feedback Well, Even When It's Off Base, Unfair, Poorly Delivered, and Frankly, You're Not in the Mood. But Sheila is in the mood to talk about difficult conversations. So we're glad to have her back. Sheila, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be back.
We want to talk difficult conversations because it seems like many are in that category. And maybe before we dive in with definitions, was this something that, as you were doing your work at the Harvard Negotiation Project, you realized that there needs to be some teaching in this?
Well, yeah, that's a good question. You know, when I joined the Harvard Negotiation Project many years ago, you know, we were teaching negotiation and influence skills, largely coming out of the book Getting to Yes, which was written back in 1979, and what we had learned since about how people can handle conflict most effectively. And people would come and take our courses and then, you know, go away and use what we were offering in terms of the approach and the skills. And, you know, many of them would come back and say, oh, this is so helpful in the following ways. But every once in a while, people would come back and say, you know, this is helpful in a lot of situations, but there are these other conversations I'm having. And when I try to use your approach, it's not helping. Mm-hmm. Or, in fact, I think it might even be making things worse. And so, you know, Harvard being Harvard, we had a reaction that's maybe typical, which is, well, if our approach isn't working for you, there must be something wrong with you. You know, like, you probably need a remedial course,
sure,
or certainly you have to hire us as consultants.
Yeah.
But we'll show you how it's done. But I think eventually we sort of came to our senses and thought, you know, maybe there's something different about particularly difficult conversations, which often happen in ongoing relationships, personal or professional, where there's strong disagreement, and there's often a lot of history and strong emotion involved. And so that's kind of how we came to trying to better understand what's going on with these conversations.
And to talk about today, how to discuss what matters most. And would like to say, if you have some questions in this area, maybe have a difficult conversation that you're waiting to have, and would like some advice, you're welcome to join in at 877-933-2484. That's our phone number. Sheila, there, you suggest that difficult conversations share a common structure. Maybe we can start there. What do they include?
Yeah, so one of the things that was interesting to me, when we first started working on the project, we figured there were 8 or 10 or 12 types of conversations, right? So, you know, talking to your spouse would be different than talking to your boss, and that would be different than giving feedback to an employee. But in fact, what we found is that if you look beneath the surface of any difficult conversation, and by that I mean beyond what people are saying or not saying to each other, because they're being polite or they're not being polite, to looking at what they're really thinking and feeling in the course of these conversations, every difficult conversation actually has the same underlying structure. It doesn't matter who we're talking to or what we're talking about. Our internal voice is preoccupied with three sort of essential things. So the first is what we call the what happened conversation, or the quote-unquote facts, meaning we each have a story about who's right, particularly what I'm right about, typically, whose fault this is and why the other person is acting this way. And together that kind of makes up our story about what's going on. But then there are two more things going on, which is that I'm trying to figure out what to do with the strong feelings that I'm having in the midst of the conversation, because I'm not really supposed to be showing those feelings, maybe particularly at work, or how I'm reacting to their feelings. What if they get mad or are upset with me? And then the third piece of the puzzle is what we call the identity conversation, that we're having a conversation with ourselves often about what this whole situation suggests about me. Does this mean I'm not a good friend, that I'm not a good daughter, that I'm not a good parent, that I am incompetent, that I don't know what I'm doing? And that's often what's driving the anxiety about the conversation, even when we hold all the cards. Like, I'm quitting my job. I hold all the cards. I just can't quite bring myself to tell my boss that I quit because I feel like it's a betrayal, or I feel so much appreciation for all they've done for me that just telling them I'm leaving feels like it's in conflict with who I am or who I want to be as a person. So those are the sort of our story about what happened, how we handle emotion, and how we tell the story of identity or who we are the three pieces underlying every difficult conversation.
And this is going on during the conversation, or this is sort of before, during, and after?
Yes.
Okay.
and it's one reason we often avoid them, right? Because that's a lot to be juggling all at once. And then you add to that the uncertainty of what, you know, all of that's going on for the other person in many cases, too. And we don't control them, and we worry about how they'll react. And so that's one of the reasons these things feel like such a mess.
Well, and I guess maybe we should talk about our motivation. Is our motivation for having conversation in the first place just because we want to deliver a message? Or, I mean, are the motivations make a difference in these three sort of common structure?
Yeah, absolutely they do. So I think we walk into these conversations, or we're thinking about having them, with a few purposes in mind that can get us in trouble. One is that we want to deliver a message about why we're right and why they, you know, owe us an apology, or why we've been badly treated, or why they should do it our way. And so if that's my purpose, then I think I'm rightly worried about it, because it's unlikely to get a positive reaction. The other purpose that we can get into trouble with is getting them to do something or not do something. So I want to figure out how to have this conversation so that they won't be upset with me or mad at me. I'm much more comfortable secretly being mad at them than risking that afterwards they might be mad at me. And so those kinds of purposes about either delivering a message or getting them to fill in the blank, agree, apologize, not be upset, are purposes that will get us into trouble.
and
should we talk about what will help?
Well, should we leave it there?
I think
I was kind of going to save that, sort of tease that a little bit longer, keep people listening longer.
In fact,
let's take a break now because we want to actually get to helpful conversations difficult conversations, and we'll do that in just a moment. Talking with Sheila Heen today. Sheila is the co-author of this best-selling book called Difficult Conversations, How to Discuss What Matters Most. And it's been updated with the answers to the 10 most frequently asked questions about difficult conversations, of which we will get to some of those anyway. And you may have one or have a difficult conversation that you'd like to get some perspective and advice on. You can join us with your call at 877-933-2484. Sheila is part of the Harvard Negotiation Project and is a lecturer in law at Harvard Law School and founder and CEO of Triad Consulting Group, and has worked with the major corporate clients, organizations, governments, people from across the globe, as well as family businesses, just helping us work through conflict and repairing relationships and making sound decisions. All those things we'll get to here in the moments ahead on Connecting Faith. To avoid difficult conversations, but that can't always happen, right? So how do you deal with, maybe there's a disagreement with your spouse, or you're negotiating with a client, or maybe there's something at work you have to deal with. We're talking about it today. Difficult conversations, how to discuss what matters most. Sheila Heen has spent a couple decades working with the Harvard Negotiation Project, developing negotiation theory and practice, and has authored this best-selling book called Difficult Conversations with her team there at the at Harvard. And she's founder and CEO of Triad Consulting Group. Was a presenter last year at the Leadership Summit, or was it a year before that already? But we're glad to have her back with us today to talk about these things. And so, Sheila, we've set up that, you know, there's a lot going on in a difficult conversation. We're looking at kind of what's happened. There's these strong feelings, and we're kind of dealing with our own identity. So what are some ways that we can actually come to some solutions, make this better?
Well, as you mentioned earlier in our little cliffhanger before the break, one of the things that gets us into trouble is thinking my job or my purpose and motivation for having the conversation is either to deliver a message of some kind, to let them know what's true or you know, why they should apologize, or to in some way manage their reaction. Like, I don't want them to get upset. I don't want to hurt their feelings or have them be upset with me, mad at me. And all of those things are liable to set us up to either do a lot of talking and very little listening, and also actually to get a bad reaction simply because it's all about us. And so what we talk about is shifting our purposes from delivering a message to having a learning conversation. If I can step to a place of curiosity to think, you know, this seems really clear to me the way that we should go about this, and I know that that's not what you think we should do about, you know, whatever, about mom's care now that we need to make some decisions about it and whether she can continue to live at home, and we disagree about what we should do about that, or we feel frustrated with each other about the roles we've been playing, if I can go into the conversation and my purpose is just to better understand why we see it differently, then I'm setting myself up to be much more likely to have a productive conversation.
And, yeah, I guess that's the key to any good relationship, though, right, is listening more. Sometimes the emotion is kind of maybe overriding that, though, isn't it?
It is overriding that. And then also, I think when we hear the advice that the best way to go about this is to listen, two things happen. One is I can fall into the trap of shifting into listening mode, but then not knowing how to get back. So I do a really good job of empathizing with you, but I walk away from the conversation not having said what I think or how I feel about it. So we might have had a good conversation because it was only your side of the story. And the other is then if I am frustrated because I don't see it the same way and I have reactions, I feel betrayed or disappointed or afraid or anxious or hurt, then it's actually really hard for me to listen. So because our internal voice gets turned up so loud during these conversations, listening is one of the first skills to go because it's too hard to listen to what you're saying to me and listen to my own reactions. That gets back to that Fran Lebowitz quote that you that you used, which I loved, about, you know, talking and waiting to talk.
Yeah, yeah. That's well, but you, and you suggest that we, you know, even though we would think, well, I shouldn't bring my feelings into this, you say we do have to express our feelings in the middle of this, right, or as part of it.
Yeah, yeah. So a lot often feelings are really at the heart of what's going on in terms of really addressing the issues between us. And so there's the surface issue, like, you know, is mom going to come home or not? But there are deeper issues about how we each feel abandoned or frustrated or disappointed in how we've handled it so far. And I would make a distinction between sharing and talking about emotion, which doesn't necessarily mean being emotional. I think there's a big difference between saying, I feel frustrated and I feel confused about how this is going to work, or I feel underappreciated for what I've done so far. That's a very calm way to describe emotion, as opposed to simply letting that frustration and betrayal and disappointment and hurt leak out by being emotional.
You talk about the difference between blame and contribution, or you use both those. Explain a bit about what do we mean by that? I guess, and maybe that takes us back to sort of the whose fault and what happened kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Part of our story about what's going on often has a piece of blame in it, either implicitly in our internal voice, because when things go wrong, we want to know whose fault it was. That's natural. I mean, if you even look at the story of the Garden of Eden, right? God comes back and says, what happened? And what does Adam say?
She did it.
She gave it to me.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And Eve is like, don't look at me. You know, it's a snake. So, I think it's almost hardwired into human beings that we want to know whose fault it is when we're struggling. I don't think that's going to go away. And the job isn't, or the answer isn't to pretend it's not there and say, well, it's nobody's fault, but, you know, if you could not be so horrible, that would be helpful. I think it's instead to take that energy and shift it toward joint contribution. And joint contribution just assumes that everybody involved did or failed to do some things that got us here. And what you did might not have been something wrong. It's just that it didn't help. So, for instance, you know, I've avoided bringing this up for a long time, and that probably hasn't helped. It doesn't mean it's 50-50, but if I can think about what have I contributed to the problem by doing or failing to do some things, and what are other players in this, what have they contributed? Well, if we can talk about, boy, going forward, here are some things I think that I would love to see change, or, you know, now looking back, I wish I had handled some things differently. That's an invitation to a really different conversation. It's very clearly a problem-solving conversation where we're willing to be mutually accountable, and our job is not to blame or punish each other or accuse, but instead to actually try to fix the problem and not be having the same conversation, right, next week or next month or next year.
Is this a matter of learning the right kind of phrases or maybe some key words to turn a conversation before it begins or in the middle of, or, you know, if they say this, then this is how you should respond?
Oh, I'm so glad that you asked that. I guess my answer is both simpler and a little more complicated.
Okay.
So I think the temptation is to think that if I just have exactly the right words, or I just, you know, lay awake and think about, well, I know what they're going to say, and then here's my rebuttal, and I'll chart my script, my path through the woods to where I want to get to. I actually think that sets us up to be really vulnerable, because if the other person doesn't follow our script, or we can't think on our feet to come up with exactly the right word, we're kind of lost in the woods. So rather than that, that's an approach I call outside in. Like, if I say the right external words, then, you know, I'll both transform the conversation and transform myself. I actually think we have to have these conversations from the inside out, meaning if I can negotiate with my own internal voice to get away from what being focused on what I'm right about to what I'm curious about and why we see it differently, if I can shift my own internal voice from blame to thinking about what have we each contributed to this and what have I contributed that I want to change, if I can see what emotions are driving us or whether they're identity issues for me, if I can change my internal stance in the conversation, then actually I can just be more transparent about what I'm really thinking. And it's not about having the magic words, because the right words and behavior will follow, and our authenticity and sincerity has a huge impact on the conversation.
But we probably do need to do a little thinking, though, whether it's staying up at night or some other time, right, in terms of maybe our feelings and our identity, right?
Ahead of time? Yeah, absolutely. So I always think the first negotiation you need to have is with yourself. And in that preparation, and by the way, on our website, we have preparation worksheets. I mean, I'm going to lay awake worrying about it no matter what. I might as well get up and put that that energy to use, rather than writing down all the bullet points of my talking points, things I want to say, which will reinforce the delivering a message approach. Instead, I'm better off getting up and doing a little of this worksheet to help negotiate with myself to change my stance toward the conversation. And then I'm in good shape to actually think about whether and how to have it.
And let's talk about the website. Seems like that would be a helpful place to send people to after this conversation.
Absolutely. So if you just go to www.diffcon, short for Difficult Conversations, so it's diffcon.com, there's a nav called Help Yourself. And under Help Yourself, there are all kinds of free resources, reader's guides for book clubs and teams who want to use the book, as well as preparation worksheets and small case studies.
All right, diffcon.com. So short for Difficult Conversations, diffcon.com, and look for some of the helps available there. Sheila Heem, founder and CEO of Triad Consulting Group, a lecturer on law at Harvard Law School, and the Harvard Negotiation Project, and she's co-authored several books, including the one we're talking today. It's called Difficult Conversations, How to Discuss What Matters Most. And we're going to get to maybe a little role-playing here coming up here after the break. Also talk about, you know, do we really need to have conversations, or are there other ways to see it? What about email and texting? Maybe that will handle it. Okay, and what if people are just being difficult? They could be crazy. Don't be looking at me, Ted. More with Sheila Heem coming up in a moment. You can join the conversation at 877-933-2484. That's 877-93-FAITH.
Hey, honey, have you gained some weight in your rear end? The dress you wear reminds me of my old girlfriend. And where'd you get those shoes? I think they're pretty lame. Would you stop talking, 'cause I'm trying to watch the game. If you're a man who wants to live a long and happy life, these are the things you don't say to your wife.
We probably need to hear another verse, don't we? That's probably one more first. All right. Okay,
I planned a hunting trip next week on your birthday. I didn't ask you, but I knew it'd be okay. Go make some dinner while I watch this fishing show. I taped it over our old wedding video. If you're a man who've done that, a long and happy life.
All right, so that's how not to do it. We're talking about how to discuss what matters most. Difficult conversations without, I guess, being a difficult schmuck like Tim Hawk is talking about. Sheila Heem is with us today.
That was like a how-to. That was how to have difficult conversations.
Yes, how to create. If you haven't created enough, That may be your next book, How to Create Difficult Conversations, and Tim's song could be the basis. Sheila Hina is a co-author of this great book called Difficult Conversations, How to Discuss What Matters Most. And maybe we should just, you know, say a bit about the marriage relationships, because that's where a lot of those can come up. You can give some examples of, you know, here's how they come up and maybe some ways to work through them.
Oh, golly. In marriage, where do we start? You know, I think that one of the things that is particularly interesting about marriage, and by the way, I've been married for a long time, 23 years.
Okay.
Notice I almost rounded up by about 10.
Sure, yeah. You didn't say happily, so it could have been 20 the, you know, 20 of the happiest 30
exactly.
years of your life. So it would have worked out.
Yeah, exactly. Well, so one of the things I think is really interesting when you look at the marriage research, and John Gottman up in Seattle is one of the people who has been at studying married couples for the longest. He says that actually about 2/3 of what we're arguing about today we'll be arguing about in 5 years.
Hmm.
And we were probably arguing about the same things 5 years ago. And it's partly because they're just not solvable. They simply reflect differences in, you know, preferences, approach, cleanliness, expectations, personality, et cetera, parenting styles. So the question of how we handle the toughest conversations in our marriages is really an ongoing question, and it suggests that those conversations aren't just – we don't just have difficult conversations in our relationships and in our marriages. In some sense, our marriage is those conversations.
Hmm.
How we handle them determines whether the relationship starts to fray and we start to feel misunderstood or dismissed or not cared about, or whether we can manage those between us and feel well-treated, even as we're not going to change each other in these particular ways. So, you know, I would say that my husband and I have a handful of things that we have been arguing about since before we were married. You know, one is the cleanliness of the house or lack thereof.
Sure.
That drives me completely insane. He of course is the bad guy here, just to be clear to
everyone
listening to this. The mess.
Wouldn't have it any other way.
Yeah, exactly. Don't ask him about it, by the way. You know, we have a little bit of difference in parenting style sometimes. And we also straddle the political divide, actually. Mm. So being able to treat someone, to separate the people from the problem and to treat our spouse with care and kindness, even as we speak up for ourselves, I think is critical to the health of the relationship. And not speaking up, just avoiding the topic, actually is shown to be correlated with higher divorce 3 to 5 years out.
Hmm. Well, you mentioned, you know, political divide. Obviously, we are in a season now where those divides seem to be getting more and more entrenched. I mean, are there ways that we can work through those difficult conversations?
Yeah, it's such a great question. And I think that there's so much going on in the current political climate that makes it seem more two-sided than it in fact is. Mm. So one factor is that the media is always going to make it more stark, more conflict-ridden. They're going to quote the most outrageous things because that's what gets people to watch. It's what gets people to listen. But I think that actually the conversations that we're having with our family and our friends and our colleagues and neighbors these days are particularly important as a populace. And I think it's actually not as simple as it sounds. It's not just red-blue. Because we all have complicated views and feelings about what's going on. Almost everybody I know had sort of conflicted feelings about the candidates themselves, yeah, whichever one you ended up voting for, as well as people split on all of these issues around the deficit and bathrooms and, you know, whether our foreign relations and military spending and arts spending. I mean, you have so many issues on the table right now, and actually you can't necessarily predict what the people around you actually think about individual issues. And so that's where it's particularly important, if we want to have a good conversation, that we let go of the idea that I'm going to persuade you I'm right and you should change your view. Oh, now that you've explained that to me, I think I'll become a Democrat or a Republican. And instead just have some curiosity about how do you see this? You know, what do you find confusing? What are you worried about? And if we can just have conversations where we actually listen to each other on those fronts, I think we'll just have richer conversations.
It seems like, I guess, thinking about having curiosity, we have to maybe have some confidence in our identity, don't we, before we can ask others about their opinions? I mean, you know, that's one of the sort of the, you know, three conversations that are within these difficult conversations. But do we need to be more settled in ourselves?
Yeah, it's interesting that we need to be both more resilient, right? In other words, learning that you disagree with me doesn't necessarily feel threatening to me because I can make up my own mind about what I think about and feel about this, but coupled with more receptivity. So learning something new or considering it from a different perspective may or may not end up influencing my view, but the more I understand, the better off I am. And that's a stance that actually isn't always comfortable to stand in. It's better, it feels safer to stand in the things we feel certain about than the things we feel like, you know what, I don't know how someone can disagree with me about this. Even that bit of curiosity helps, rather than saying, I don't know why you're so stupid. Which is a very different kind of wondering, perhaps.
Yes. Yes. Although we, yeah, that would be something where we wouldn't want to say that out loud, perhaps. But
it's leaking out sure. Because we're thinking it,
that's
right?
True.
And it's very
true.
Clear.
Yeah, that's true. By the way, speaking of leaking out, is this something that difficult conversations need to happen face to face, or a person talking as opposed to, you know, shooting emails or texts?
Yeah. Email is very tempting because we get to think about what we want to say and try to craft it perfectly. And I think a lot of difficult conversations are happening over email. There are a couple of problems with email. One is it's not really dialogue. It's actually serial monologue. You know, the third line, I'm triggered by something that you've said, and then I'm reading the rest of your email through that frustration or feeling misunderstood or, you know, well, you're wrong about that. You don't have the whole story. And then I write back with that sort of frustration or self-righteous stance. So now you're triggered by the first line of my email, and now I'm triggered every time I just see your name in my inbox. So text and email tend to be the places where conflict escalates most quickly. So, yeah, what we tend to say is that if a conflict starts on email, it's not going to be resolvable on email. And if you are having a tough conversation on email and it's not helping, then pick up the phone at the very least, if not try to have it in person.
And as we've talked about, and you've addressed it, I mean, bringing feelings into the workplace and the conversation, that's not a problem. Somehow we think that it should be, but it isn't, is it?
Well, every workplace actually already has feelings in it. It's just that some are expressed more easily and more often. They're sort of sanctioned feelings like, you know, pride and persistence and enthusiasm, or even anger sometimes is actually a feature of some workplaces or some teams, although we don't talk about it explicitly. It's sort of leaking out in people's tone and behavior. So the feelings are already there. And by the way, we're already having them privately as we read our email and sit in meetings. So our suggestion is actually just to pay more attention to the emotional reaction that you're having, and then think about, do I have a good purpose in raising it? Because sometimes if I simply say, Look, I rather than argue about the way I think this should be done again, let me just step back to say I'm frustrated because I feel like we're going in circles and I'm not sure why. So I'm naming frustration and I'm naming uncertainty. And that's actually getting to the heart of what's really going on and is much more likely to invite a more productive conversation about how we want to go about addressing it than simply repeating myself about what I still think should happen.
So a listener call in just said, you know, there are many people who've just said, well, just let it go, let it go. You know, let the soundtrack run through your head.
Yeah.
But she said, I found the problem just stays when we do that. So how can we know when to address something or if it just needs to be let go?
Yeah. You know, it's funny because the first half of the Difficult Conversations book takes a look at the underlying structure. Because if you understand that structure and you can see the landmarks, you can actually navigate through a conversation. But the second half of the book picks up the question, should I even have this conversation? And I think it has to do primarily with your purposes. Life is too short to engage every difficult conversation. So one is, who is it with and how important is it? Two, if I don't have it, can I let it go? Because some things I think you can with time. It's like, doesn't seem as important to me this week as it did a week ago or a month ago. But I think there are other times where we use that as a rationalization and instead the problem simply festers or gets worse. And the third is, if I'm going to have it, then can I find purposes like learning, being curious, and finding a solution, speaking up for myself while being willing to listen to them, that will be more likely to result in a productive conversation where at the end of it we're actually in a better place. Even if we still disagree, we're in a better place to figure out what to do.
Well, we've been talking Difficult Conversations today with Sheila Heen, the title of the book, Difficult Conversations, How to Discuss What Matters Most. There's some great resources available on the website, DiffCon, short for Difficult Conversations, DiffCon.com, and look for the helps there, and you can get some good practical helps, and of course, check out the book as well. Sheila is founder and CEO of Triad Consulting Group, a lecturer on law at Harvard Law School and the Harvard Negotiation Project, and has been our guest today. Sheila, we always enjoy chatting with you, and thanks for giving us some good insight today.
Thank you. I loved being on.
We'll do it again sometime because there'll be a few more difficult conversations we can get queued up on here in the moments ahead. Anyway, Sheila Heen joining us today on Connecting Faith. I'm glad to have you tuned in. I hope you found it helpful. And we're going to talk a little bit more about how we can be peacemakers and have some relational wisdom. We'll get to that just ahead. Difficult conversations and how we can discuss what matters most. You know, we need to do it with the wisdom. And one of our conversations not too long ago was with Ken Sandy, who is a founder of Peacemaker Ministries and Relational Wisdom 360, RW360. And Ken is an engineer, a lawyer, and a mediator, and has a great ability to pull out acronyms for us and acrostics to help us remember important principles. And so if you got a notepad, you may want to just write down a few things. We're going to give you a few letters and acrostics that will help you in speaking life and in having those difficult conversations.
We basically have four acrostics. And, of course, the church has been using acrostics for 2,000 years. One of the first one was ichthus, the Greek word for fish, Jesus Christ, Savior, Son of God. And so in the same way, we use some very simple acrostics. The first one is we call the SOG plan, S-O-G, and that is the overarching acrostic that in any relational situation, we should try to be self-aware, other-aware, and most importantly, God-aware. And then we have three other acrostics that help us practice these skills even more specifically, focusing on one of those three regions. So, for example, to become more God-aware and God-engaging, we want to follow a reliable GPS, God Positioning System. And that stands for, in any situation, our goal should be to glorify God, to be pursuing God, a deeper knowledge and understanding of His grace, His character, and then to serve God, to imitate Jesus, where He said, the one who sent me is with me. He's never left me alone, for I always do what pleases Him. And if you use that as your GPS in life, it'll keep you on course much better than just bouncing around by worldly values and desires. The acrostic we use for becoming more self-aware and self-engaging is to read, R-E-A-D, read yourself accurately. And that stands for recognize your emotions and name them. That engages your whole brain when you actually name something. To evaluate the source. Why do I feel this way? What's going on inside of me? What's the desire that's driving me and possibly leading me astray? A stands for anticipate the consequences. What if I give in to this desire? Let's say I'm really unhappy with my boss. If I storm into his office and give him a piece of my mind, I may be standing outside on the sidewalk shortly. And then finally, the last one, D, is to direct that emotion in a constructive direction. How do we channel the power of our emotions? It's like wind in the sail of a sailboat. How do we take that power and rather than being capsized by our emotions, how do we use it to actually propel us forward in our relationships? And then finally, the last acrostic is what we call serve. If you want to be more other-aware and other-engaging, serve, S-E-R-V-E, every person you meet. And that stands for five other relational skills, which is to smile. And there's a lot of significance to a smile. It's not a small thing. To explore and empathize, to ask questions, get to know people, show empathy. To reconcile with people if we sense that there's a breach in our relationship or we see some friends who may have some conflict. Or most importantly, can we share the gospel and reconcile people to God? Fourth one is V, is to value, is to show appreciation and respect and admiration for other people. And then finally, encourage is to put wind under their wings, that when people have engaged us, whether it's just passing in the terminal in the airport where we just smile pleasantly at somebody or where we sit down and spend an hour talking to somebody who's hurting, whatever situation we're in, our goal is at the end of that conversation, people feel they're like an eagle who's caught an updraft and there's wind under their wings. So as people live out those four basic acrostics, it can radically change their relationships.
You talked about engaging your whole brain. Kind of go back and say a little bit more about that, especially as I guess it relates to our emotions. Maybe we're not always thinking clearly when we're thinking emotionally.
Oh, boy, I could give you story after story of that in my own life. Yeah, there's just some fascinating studies. This is where there's a lot of benefit of studying what the emotional intelligence people are coming up with, is when we become intensely emotional, it's like your computer processing a very big program. Your central processing unit is so taken up processing that one program that it doesn't have processing ability left over for something else that you're doing, and you have to wait. And your brain is the same way. It's got a limited capacity to handle data and sensations and energy. So when you're intensely emotional, the limbic part of your brain, and particularly the amygdala, which is sort of your emotional filing cabinet, gets so active, it can overpower and actually, to some degree, cut out your neocortex. And that's where your rational thinking, your memorized scripture, your life lessons, your logic, your language skills are. And so one of the ways to force your neocortex to get involved, you're feeling very, very emotional, is simply to name the emotions. Okay, what am I feeling now? You can think this or you can even talk to yourself. What am I feeling? I'm feeling angry. The very act of defining that forces that part of your brain to get engaged again, and you start thinking using rational processes and also impulse control, so you don't say and do things. So a lot of our training is actually addressing how do we recognize emotional hijacking, those situations that our emotions hijack are typically our mouth, and then how do we bring those things under the lordship of Christ. My thoughts, emotions, words, and actions are always being used to honor and to please Him.
You talk about the pause principle. I mean, there is something to be said for just being slow to speak and quick to listen.
Absolutely. And the pause principle is another one of our acrostics. And, of course, just the very word is helpful, to pause, to slow down, to think. But there's actual specific steps. So we use the pause principle in negotiating substantive issues, material issues. And basically that stands for preparing. You want to pray, think it through, get your options. You want to affirm the relationship, show respect and concern for other people. You want to understand their interests as well as you understand your own. Paul commands that in Philippians 2:4. He says, look out for their interests as well as your own. And then you can search for creative solutions, think about different ways to meet everybody's needs, and then evaluate those things objectively. So again, it's just a very simple acrostic, but it gathers a wealth of biblical information and even many examples in the Bible of people negotiated in life and death situations.
Are there things that maybe we're not doing now that we can do? I mean, obviously, you know, recognizing our emotions, evaluating their source, anticipating the consequences, you know, directing them to a constructive course. That's the read acrostic. But is there a first or second step that we should, if we don't get anything else out of the conversation today, here's one thing that can really make a difference?
Well, I would say, I mean, just those acrostics. I would encourage people to come to our website, and on the front page, there's it says blog topics, and you can go down and you'll see RW acrostics. And there's just some very simple, very concise teaching there. To simply take one of those acrostics, whichever one you want to focus on, whether it's becoming more God-aware, self-aware, other-aware, and then just practicing it for, you know, day in and day out. There's a little video we use in our training that just shows how people, we all have a process called selective perception. We go through the day, thousands of data points coming to us. Every time you glance across the room, there's thousands of colors and faces and shapes. And your brain has to process that and screen out the vast majority of information. And we often screen out important information. So learning how to be more sensitive. So when you walk into the office and one of the assistants is just unusually quiet today, instead of just walking by because you're consumed with the project you got to get started on, you stop and say, hey, how are you today? What's going on? And she may say, oh, it's okay, it's okay. But she's really saying, do you care enough to press in? And do you stand there? Do you say, no, what's happening? I can see something's troubling you. That's how we build rich relationships.
Talking relational wisdom with Ken Sandy, founder of Peacemaker Ministries and Relational Wisdom 360. And as you mentioned, there's a number of the acrostics, and you can find them on their website, rw360.org. Check that out, rw360.org. Talked about the GPS, right? The glorifying God, pursuing God, and serving God. There's the smile one, or the serve one. It starts with a smile, and then explore and be empathetic, reconcile, value, and show respect, and then encourage. Some acronyms that acrostics you can hang on to today. It might make a difference, and we'll talk about upcoming programming here in just a moment.
I think we have difficulties in our lives and struggles in our lives and broken dreams like I did, and God wants to fulfill our dreams, but probably not in the way that we imagined.
You know, God can use our brokenness for His glory. Hi, I'm Steve Douglas, and today on Making Your Life Count, Sharon Janes explains how she came to realize God's plan for her life.
My husband and I experienced years of infertility and then the loss of a child. But God was showing me that even though my medical record might say infertile, that I was fertile. He had made me fertile in ministry. And what He began to show me is that, you know, sometimes life doesn't turn out like we thought it would, and we have broken dreams in our lives. But if we will give those broken dreams to Him, He will make them into something more beautiful than we ever imagined.
Even in pain and suffering, God can work through you. So be open and reach out to people through your experience.
Hey, just a reminder, coming up next Monday, we're going to talk a little bit more about some of these issues of conflict. In fact, there's a wonderful book we're going to reference called Redeeming Conflict. Garrido will join us. She's a good friend of Sheila Heen, so that'll be a good conversation tomorrow.
I'm looking forward to that.
Next Monday, I should say. Next Monday.
Very helpful, yes.
Yeah. Tomorrow, we're going to talk money with Ron Blue.
It's been a while since we've had him on.
Looking forward to having him back with us here. And so you may have a question or two. You can save it up and join us tomorrow on the broadcast here on Connecting Faith. By the way, if you missed part of today's show, we mentioned a couple of websites, rw360.org or DiffCon for Difficult Conversations.com, DiffCon.com. Both resources help you out in those difficult challenges and conversations. And again, if you missed part of the show, we post the interviews on our website so you can listen to them again, share them with a friend. Just go to the Connecting Faith show page at myfaithradio.com. Thanks for listening to this Connecting Faith podcast. These conversations are available because of listener support. And you can make a gift right now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of Connecting Faith, you can subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and growing the awareness and impact of Connecting Faith.